Hi there, I'm Bill DeYoung. This is the Catalyst Sessions for Friday. Thanks for joining us. We're attempting and hopefully succeeding in kind of connecting our arts community, keeping us all together in these awful, weirdo times. Today's guest, I'm so proud to say, is Frank Strunk III, who is an artist here in Pinellas County, and your studio's in Gulfport.
That's correct. And
Frank is a metal artist, which doesn't necessarily mean he's a heavy metal artist. He works in metals. I mean, you know, it's to each his own, right? But it's so fascinating to me what you do, and thanks for being here with us today.
Hey, great. Thank you for having me.
Well, first and foremost, you have an exhibition starting Saturday, which is that right? The 5th?
It's tomorrow.
Tomorrow, yeah. Saturday.
Yeah, tomorrow at 7 p.m. right on Facebook Live.
Right, and this is Pandemia?
Pandemia, yeah.
Okay. First and foremost, tell the folks at home, like, where you come up with that name and why.
Well, I mean, I guess the basic answer is that everything in this show is was conceived and designed, executed, finished, and assembled within the time that this whole global pandemic has affected our mankind, really. So it's I know that this is new for damn near everybody, and as a people have asked a lot of artists, like, how is this affecting you? How is it affecting your creativity? I know other artists have asked me those questions, and you know, and it's a huge scale of different ways that it's affected me as a creator.
Go ahead, please.
Oh yeah. So Pandemia is really a name that's just like, this is what happens in this pandemic, born of the pandemic, or in spite of the pandemic.
I'm seeing a lot of these masks on your Instagram and your other social accounts, and I think this is from the show. The masks figure in what you do a lot, but with this is a pandemic era mask, I'm assuming. What am I looking at here, and what does this represent?
Well, all the masks, you know, the subject of mask is rich with metaphor. Yeah. In and out of this pandemic, you know, social media is a mask, cosmetics are masks. And without being too, I didn't want to like just beat people over the head with my concept. So the show really is only masks. It's 20 masks of different construction and different designs. And they're based off the plague doctor masks. From earlier plagues. And my understanding of the history of them is that many people thought that the disease was spread through odor. And so they would take these masks and the long snouts and put various herbs and things that smelled good and to defeat this. And so they figured if you couldn't smell it, you're not gonna catch this thing. Well, that was disproven by germ theory. And
Are we talking about we're not talking about like the 1918 pandemic here. This is earlier than that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I just know that they,
it's creepy, man. I'm telling you, it's what
it has a creep factor to it. Yeah. When you put them on, they don't get any less creepy. but they also, they're not meant to be worn. You can see, I guess in that photo, they have, a cool stand that comes with it, so it can be, you know, a small sculptural piece. And I also have made stands that are hangers that you can hang them on the wall as well as an art piece.
I think I have another one here that I nicked off your social media. Wait, is it push the right button, Bill? One of these days, you know. Anyway, yeah, here's another one, and there's something vaguely futuristic about this one too. This brings Star Wars to mind, you know, and it's very much, this ties in with that whole secret society, Darth Vader thing.
Yeah, they do. They hide your initial identity, but they also, with intent and by design, they create another identity. So maybe it's, you know, through this pandemic, you want to appear stronger than you really are. If you're falling apart, this mask will give you a, you know, impart to the public that
you're okay. But I mean, if you're ill and the doctor comes in the room and he's wearing this thing, aren't you going to just jump out the nearest window and fear.
You're gonna freak out. You're gonna think, man, I have this disease, and now what the heck is happening? Yeah, I always thought that. I mean, people had to have thought, boy, this is the Grim Reaper coming in to take me now.
Man, and this guy, it's very bird-like. It has this sort of, I'm feeling like a Rod Serling sign or some kind of science fiction thing.
Yeah, the beak thing, it comes off as a beak, but it's this long snout where they would place all the herbs and the flowers and stuff to overcome the smell of them.
Well, so Pandemia is, what did you say, 20 masks?
It's going to be 20, yeah.
Yeah. How often do you do exhibitions, I mean, in the real world? This one is virtual, but I mean, do you have a showroom there, a gallery in your studio, or do you, I mean, I know I've seen your stuff around, but I mean, do you do periodic solo shows?
I do, yeah, periodically. I have to have a reason though. I mean, I build an entire show. And so it's, you know, I don't really try to, you know, execute a solo exhibition unless there's a good reason for it. Mm-hmm. And I do group shows at like Mize Gallery and stuff. And you know, other group shows, but those are just little one piece shows, and they're heavily themed. But my preference is to build the show with a solid concept and execute it to the end.
You've been involved in this wearable art stuff too. And in fact, I found a photo, this one actually, of some, which I think is something of yours.
And yeah.
There's a sort of a Pandemia factor in this too, Frank. I mean,
well, that was one of the first times I ever did I did any real headpieces for those shows.
Yeah.
And it was really, you know, that was those headpieces. I had four of those guys walk in the last show, and it was really about how closed off, how much we close ourselves off from real living and real experience, obviously through, you know, being buried in your phone all the time and having all of your input kind of filtered. Models were walking the catwalk at a certain point, all the lights went out and they all pulled out their phones and stared at their phones.
Wow.
And so all you could see is like kind of these floating heads, and they all wore those same black suits. But I mean, I guess maybe that was, I don't know, man, I tell you, doing wearable art is such an opportunity because they're all on living people, and you get to make a pretty heavy social commentary when you got people on the catwalk. It's completely different than having static pieces.
What I'm really interested in is how I want to talk about, you know, your road to becoming an artist, of course, but how did you find your medium? How did you find that it was metal? I mean, did you start off as a painter? Were you working in clay and going, this doesn't work for me? What happened?
Well, I started out in photography. Huh. Yeah, when I was young, my dad, who had a few cameras, gave me one of his for his birthday, and I started shooting. Yeah. And it was all film. And so I think that really gave me a basic tool of sight and composition, how to compose through the viewfinder, and, you know, to create positive space and negative space. I never took any classes in it, though. It was just, I've never taken any formal education.
I think that can ruin an artist. You know, I think that if someone informs you about a certain technique or a way to do things, then
right.
your own sort of natural thing might be, eclipsed somehow. I would agree with that.
Well, yeah. Well, it can certainly influence, and it's up to you as an artist how much of your formal education you want to let appear in your art. But I think that maybe if you have enough, say, formal arts education, I would hope that it wouldn't stop you from being naturally curious and bravely innovative in your own work, because there's more than one way to paint. There's more than 100 ways to paint, I think the self-taught artists, maybe we since we don't have any of those lines to draw in, we just do our own thing.
It's, but, you know, it's in its purest sense, it's folk art, you know. know, it's just the end result of all the influences that are in you and not your teachers and not what you learn in a classroom or in a book or something. How did you get from photography to metal though? We got to fill that.
I worked construction for a while, and I worked in wood, from wood and concrete, and I used mostly discarded construction materials because I just found beauty in the destruction of things, not in the act of destroying them, but you know, when you're tearing something down and you're hauling stuff away from a construction site, a lot of times I would take this stuff and throw it in the back of my truck and go home and try to make stuff out of it. And so I didn't start working in metal. Like, I'm not a certified welder or anything, but I am a competent metal fabricator. The transition started, I think it was, I was working on this construction crew in Tampa, and we were just about done for the day, and we were up on this roof, and I saw sparks flying like 4 or 5 yards away, and it was just crew of metal fabricators were installing a metal post for a gazebo, and they were welding things. So everybody else went to go, and our crew went to go drink beer. And I went over there and I was like, hey, is it cool if I hang out and watch you guys? And they're like, no problem. Welders are really cool people. I can tell you that from the welders I've met.
Yeah, I've met a few and I'll go there, sure.
Yeah, they're really chill. And I talked to them about what kind of welders they were using and you know what they were doing. And one dude there just said, hey man, you can get your own welder for about $100, $150. And it was terrible. It was an awful welder. And and I also was a awful metal fabricator for a long time. I don't know who said it, is you have to be willing to be bad at something for a very long time until you can become good at it. And I was bad for a long time. The stuff I made was terrible. My welds were awful. But I wanted to learn it so bad that I just did. I just kept at it.
That's true in so many things. That's true in journalism. You know, if I look at something I wrote in, say, the 80s, I've been doing this a long time. I mean, give me a lighter. I'm setting it on fire, you know. But that's how you learn, right?
Yeah. I feel the way about my earlier work.
Yeah.
And I'll see it hanging somewhere. I'll see it in someone's house, and I'm like, oh, God.
I pay you to take that down.
I'm like, how can I make that disappear? Yeah.
Well, it's interesting to me, like an artist's own journey. Do you the transition, I mean, do you literally wake up one day and say, okay, I'm an artist today? Or is it the first time somebody hands you money? Or when you say, I'm not going to work construction anymore, I'm not doing that or whatever anymore, this is what I'm doing, therefore I'm an artist. Where does that jump come in? What did it happen for you?
Well, it was gradual. Yeah, because I, you know, at first when I made my art, I think, and this is probably true of a lot of artists, but I'll just speak for myself and say that I didn't charge people for my art at all, or I just terribly underpriced it because I just figured it wasn't worthy of purchase. It was just something that I did and made. And I would do that while I would be employed. So there wasn't one day when I woke up and said, I am an artist. It gradually crept up on me that I was, and I could see other people's art around and thought, well, I mean, I can execute my medium at that level, and I can be as, you know, I'm willing to be vulnerable. I'm willing to, you know, I don't want to make metal fish. You know, we live in Florida, my studio's in Gulfport. I mean, you can find people who will make metal fish for you.
And I would imagine you can. I've never been looking for that, but.
And I could execute all that, but it's just my voice is not that, you know?
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I still have days where I feel like I'm not really an artist. You know, the self-doubt just comes crushing. And I thought, well, man, what am I now? You know, so.
That's part and parcel of it, you know, but there's also that moment too, when you get involved in, and I heard you talk about this once, that, you know, the business of art versus how do you maintain your artistic integrity? Do people commission things from you? Do people come and say, you know, not necessarily I want a fish, but I want a piece that looks sort of like this?
Yeah. Well, I try not to do too much work for people who say, can you make me one of these? That's tough.
So it's just make me something of yours.
They'll say, I love it when people, I don't know when the phrase was coined, is when people say, I want kind of a Strunkian light fixture.
And Strunkian. So,
you know,
I like that.
Yeah. Somebody's doing something. No, it's not me, dude. I'm in a kind of industrial area. Yeah. And so there's a lot of working people around here, so they're going to work,
What's the process like, Frank? I mean, you sort of get an idea first and say, I'm going to make this out of, I need certain pieces of, I don't know, whatever your materials are, aluminum, copper, whatever. Or do the pieces, does what you have in front of you suggest it to you? This is what I'm going to be when you're done with me. Or do you start with an idea? How does it work?
Well, it's all different ways, it starts usually just with a whim or a connection to an idea, an inspiration. Mm-hmm. And then, once it gets started, it's definitely a kind of a dialogue between me and the material and the tools and whether I'm, and it's an ongoing dialogue. I mean, certainly whether I'm going to be able to execute the idea with the materials that I think, with the tools I have, with the experience I have, or am I not the artist to do this? Am I not just not qualified? Am I not going to be able to do it? So I have, a lot of honest conversations with myself, certainly with these masks. I'd never made anything even close to these masks before. And when I started, they were awful. And I threw a bunch of them away. I took pictures of all the bad ones just so I could kind of laugh at myself and be like, you got to have a sense of humor. It's certainly about your own work and certainly about how you critique your own work. But the first masks I made were terrible.
I used to ask people who make records this, you cut and you cut and you overdub and you do it again. How do you know when it's done?
You just know. It's a connection. You're holding this piece. It's just stimuli, really. The light reflects off the piece, goes into your optic nerve, resonates in your brain, endorphins flow. You say, this is what I wanted. And then you go to the next one.
And you just know. Yeah, that's kind of what musicians say, too. You know when you know. It's just that.
It sounds right.
What are we looking at behind you there? I'm looking at a tricycle and maybe a dress stand. Do you collect pieces of things, or are those things you've made, or what are we looking at?
Well, the tricycle is there's a little boy mannequin on there. And my girlfriend Bethany and I, we nicknamed him Baby Sparky. He's a little guy that I got out of a dumpster, and
Baby Sparky.
He was missing an arm. And so I gave him a little fake arm that has a crow's neck on it, and it has a little light bulb on the end of it. He's got this big smile on his face, and it just shows he's just totally cool with having this fake arm.
Wow.
And then a buddy of mine.
Strunkian prosthetic.
What's that?
Yes.
Strunkian prosthetic. Exactly.
Like that.
Yeah, and I had him on for the longest time. I was a bachelor, and I had him in this cool little high chair at my kitchen table, and he would just sit there, and had a little bowl of rusty bits of metal in front of him. He was like this little installation. And then my buddy Matt said, "Hey, dude, I have this old tricycle, and do you want it?" So I haul ass over there. I get this tricycle. And so I mounted him on that tricycle, and that's just where he lives now. He's really happy.
I can't see him, but tilt your camera up a minute. Is he sitting up there now?
Yeah.
There he is.
Yeah. That's him.
That's
He's very happy. Yeah, that's where he lives. It's totally cool.
Famously on the outside of your studio space there, I think, is painted the words "no scrap metal." Which I've seen in videos. I haven't been over there, but... Are you a collector? I mean, do you, like you said, just pick up things?
I do, that's what happens. As soon as you start welding, it's a bit of a virus. It's a bit of an infection, and it gets in your brain, and suddenly you realize you can join two pieces of metal together.
Yeah.
And from that point on, there's this lens that comes over your eyes, and you our radar, you see every piece of scrap metal anywhere. Bethany has it too. We'll be walking, you'll kick a piece of something that you think is a gravel, it's a little piece of metal, and we're just like, look at this spring, it is perfect. And you want to put it in a piece. So little pieces of rusted metal they're magic. The no scrap metal thing came from, I have a I do have a scrap metal pile that scrappers in Gulfport and St. Pete will come by and pick up
stuff
that I'm discarding. And one night I had a sculpture out side of my studio that I needed to rust more before I could seal it and deliver it. I had it out there and somebody stole it. And they probably, you know, it was a couple $1,000 sculpture and I'm sure they probably got like $7 for it in scrap. Wow. So I was mad and I had a few beers and I just spray painted that on the side of my building. No scrap metal. And then that's it. They just
start. I got one more picture I want to look at because this is one of your more well-known ones. And I wanted to ask you about it. It is this one. This is wall art, I think. You've got this.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about this and where it is too. This I've seen images of a lot.
Well, I don't know where it is now, but it was in a restaurant in Gulfport called La Fogata.
That must be, yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I did a series of those dollar bills. I had a 9-foot long one in a bank in Tampa, US Ameribank, in their lobby. But it's the series called Almighty. Uh-huh. And it's really, I think, the way a lot of artists feel about money. It's a love-hate kind of thing. We hate to do it for the money, but let's face it, I mean, money's going to buy our food and pay for our studio rent, so we do it.
Buys a lot of scrap metal.
It does. It buys everything that gives us comfort, even though we're willing to live lives that are not driven by comfort, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, they're just these big, I innovated this process that allows me to rust text and imagery into the surface of metal. And so this was, the dollar bill was probably the most predominant use of that.
I can't even say why it's fascinating to me as, you know, the viewer. It draws you in. Completely. Are all these plates done separately or was it done as one piece?
Well, the original file is created as one and then I bang it into smaller pieces and then apply the stencil and then the acids and all the chemicals and then I rivet everything together into one piece at the end. So it's really just an absolute mess up until the last assembly. Yeah. So as the creator of it, I'm just shaking my head the whole time until I start to assemble it. And then I'm like, it's genius.
Yeah, it's genius. Once again, that moment comes when you know it's right. It's exactly right. What's next on your plate, Frank? What happens next? What are you working on?
After a pandemia?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I have some, nothing. I don't have a show planned. I can tell you that I've wanted to do a show of small kinetic works because I know that this kinetic pieces are a favorite of a lot of folks. But and I have like 7 or 8 small kinetic pieces that are in various stages of assembly. So I think I probably want to do that.
Oh yeah. Let's remind people your website is it frankstrunk3.com or just frankstrunk.com?
It's just frankstrunk.com.
I assume your dad, who was a printer, wasn't he, in D.C., was Frank Strunk Jr.?
He was Frank Strunk Jr. Yeah, he owned a large commercial printing place. But my dad is also a writer. So if you just Google Frank Strunk, you'll get a bunch of the books he's written. He's a novelist.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And then the rest of the hits will be me.
So your website is frankstrunk.com.
Yes, sir.
You can view the sculpture and the wall art and some stuff from Pandemia, which is Saturday. That's tomorrow, folks, September 5th.
Yeah, so, it's going to be right here. Yeah.
So Chad Mize does this too. So you just sort of, it's virtual. Somebody's following you with a camera or you've got your phone or you're saying, here's this, here's that, and talk about it.
Well, this one's going to be, I'll just have a static camera and I'll be bringing pieces into the show. The frame and stuff.
And that's here on Facebook.
Yeah, here on Facebook Live.
And I was going to say Frank Demia. Yeah, okay.
Demia.
Strong the third. Absolute pleasure. Pandemia is September 5th right here on Facebook, on your Facebook page.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Will there be like a recording, like a video of it, like to live perpetually so people can check it out later?
Well, probably not perpetually, but I'll leave it up for a few days.
There you go. Yeah. Well, hey, man, it's great talking to you. Thanks so much.
Right on. Good talking to you. Thank you.
See you soon, buddy.
All right. Bye.